March 11th, 1985, Waverly, Georgia. While holding a Bible class at the Rising Daughters Baptist Church, 66-year-old Deacon Harold Swain is summoned to the vestibule by an unidentified man. Harold is shot to death by the stranger, and when his 63-year-old wife, Thelma Swain, goes to check on him, she is fatally shot as well. Years later, a suspect named Dennis Perry is charged and convicted of the two murders, and receives two life sentences. However, controversy surrounds the conviction, thanks to missing evidence, questionable eyewitness testimony, and an alibi which supposedly placed Perry at another location at the time of the murders, so questions remain about whether the right person is in prison for this crime. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we are going to be examining a pretty controversial story, the 1985 murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. Now, this is one of the earliest cases featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and if you watched it on Amazon Prime, you might be wondering why I have elected to cover this one. At the end of the segment, there's a brief update which mentions that a suspect named Dennis Perry, who, quote-unquote, had a grudge against Harold, was sent to prison for these murders, so on the surface, it seems like this case is completely solved. But there's actually a whole lot more to this story. Perry has always maintained his innocence, and claims that he had an alibi placing him hours away when the crime took place. Some of the evidence which was used to convict him has been called into question, and key pieces of physical evidence which might have exonerated Perry happened to go missing before his trial. In fact, one of these pieces of evidence was actually displayed on camera by Robert Stack himself during the Unsolved Mysteries segment, but no one knows what happened to it. Now, it's worth mentioning that in order to avoid the death penalty, Perry elected to waive his right to appeal his conviction, so even if he's innocent, it would probably take a miracle to get him out of prison. However, the Georgia Innocence Project agreed to take Perry's case a few years ago, so I thought it would be worth exploring whether the right guy is actually incarcerated for this crime, or if someone else got away with it. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play Music. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is finally on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards from yours truly, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. Our story begins in 1985 in the small town of Waverly, Georgia, a predominantly African-American community located in Camden County. Our central figures are an African-American couple who have been married 43 years, 66-year-old Harold Swain and his 63-year-old wife, Thelma. Harold is the deacon at the Rising Daughters Baptist Church and a community leader. Thelma is actively involved in church activities, and they are both considered to be very well-liked, well-respected citizens. On March 11th, the Swains were holding their weekly Bible study class with 9 female parishioners from their congregation. At around 8:50 p.m., one of the women, Vanzola Williams, excused herself because she had to leave early to pick up her daughter. She walked out into the vestibule and encountered a white male with light-colored, shoulder-length hair who appeared to be in his mid-20s. The man walked over to the doorway and pointed at Harold, telling Williams that he needed to speak with him. Some of the other parishioners managed to catch a glimpse of the man as Williams walked over to fetch Harold. After Harold walked to the vestibule, Williams exited out the front door. Immediately thereafter, a struggle ensued, and everyone inside the church heard gunshots. While most of the parishioners retreated to Harold's office, Thelma ran towards the vestibule to check on her husband. She arrived to discover that Harold was now lying dead on the floor after receiving 3 gunshots to the chest and 1 to the back of the head. Before Thelma had a chance to react, the stranger shot her in the chest before fleeing the scene. After hearing the gunshots, Vanzola Williams had run to the church's back door and joined the other parishioners in Harold's office. They attempted to use the phone to call for help, but discovered that the line was dead. The women remained hidden for 20 minutes until one of them decided to run out of the church to her car and drove to a convenience store to contact the police. By the time they arrived at the scene, Harold and Thelma were both dead, and their killer was long gone. The Camden County Sheriff's Office brought in the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, the GBI, to assist them, and they would discover that the phone lines outside the church had been cut. 2 separate pairs of eyeglasses were found at the murder scene, one of which belonged to Harold, and the other which could not be matched to anybody and had presumably been dropped by the killer. The makeshift glasses had a prescription for a far-sighted person with astigmatism in his right eye. The lenses were thick, the frame appeared to have been pocked with a welding torch, and the earpieces did not match, as the right one was wrapped in tape. This suggested that the glasses were owned by someone who did not have the money to afford a decent pair. 2 unidentified Caucasian hairs were also found in the glasses' hinges. The initial theory from investigators was that the killer was a transient, as the church was located next to Highway 17, and it was common for transients to stop there for handouts and a free meal. However, it turned out that $300 had been left behind in Harold's pocket, suggesting that robbery was not the motive. Vanzola Williams and the other parishioners who caught a glimpse of the stranger all provided a description of him, but the problem is that their details often contradicted one another. For example, Williams, who spoke directly with the man, claimed he wasn't wearing glasses at the time, but some of the other witnesses recalled seeing glasses on his face. Regardless, a composite sketch was made of the suspect with the best information they had at their disposal. A clerk at a nearby store also claimed that about a half hour before the murders, a blonde, bespectacled man matching the shooter's description came inside and purchased a Pepsi. He did not have the full 55 cents to pay for it, and went back out to his car to grab some extra change. He drove away in what was described as an orange Plymouth-type vehicle and appeared to be heading in the direction of the church. Anyway, the next major development would occur nearly 4 months later in Telfair County on July 5th. Police pulled over a vehicle containing 3 occupants for a seemingly routine traffic violation. However, they soon discovered some unregistered weapons inside the trunk, including a submachine gun, so the 3 men were arrested. One of them was Donnie Barentine, who hailed from Marianna, Florida, and investigators would soon learn from 3 witnesses that Barentine had drunkenly waved a pistol around at a party while bragging that he had murdered a black preacher and his wife at a Georgia church. Jeff Cottrell, one of the suspects who was arrested alongside Barentine, was also at the party and claimed that Barentine was accompanied by an unidentified blonde man, and Barentine had stated that he waited outside the church while his partner went inside to do the shootings. Barentine also said that the motive for the murders was to draw Harold Swain's son-in-law out of hiding, since he supposedly owed a drug debt to Barentine's cousin. Interestingly enough, Cottrell also claimed that when they were pulled over by police in Telfair County, they had been on their way to Macon in order to perform a hit on a drug dealer on the order of Barentine's cousin, and that he'd instructed them to cut the phone lines to the dealer's house before they went inside to kill him. When questioned, Barentine did admit that he had bragged about committing the murders at the party, but claimed he was lying and did not actually do it. Barentine also failed a polygraph test, and he did have a bit of a resemblance to the composite sketch of the suspect. Time card showed that Barentine was at his workplace in Marianna, Florida, until he clocked out at 3:29 p.m. on March 11th, but GBI Special Agent Joe Gregory personally took a drive from there to Waverly to see if Barentine would have had enough time to make the trip and commit the shootings at around 8:50 p.m. Marianna was located in the central time zone and was actually 1 hour behind Waverly, but when Gregory made the drive, he claimed he arrived at the church with 30 to 45 minutes to spare. Vanzola Williams was asked to view a police lineup with Barentine, but even though she thought he resembled the shooter, she could not positively identify him, as he had short hair by this point. However, she did think Barentine was wearing the same type of scuffed boots that the killer wore. Investigators wanted to pursue murder charges against Barentine, but the local district attorney thought there just wasn't enough evidence and believed that the witnesses from the party who heard him brag about the crime were unreliable. While Barentine was not linked to the Swain murders, he still wound up receiving a 5-year prison sentence on weapons charges. Another interesting development took place when Joe Gregory noticed a resemblance between the composite sketch of the killer and the composite sketch of a suspect which he discovered in a state crime bulletin. In October of 1981, an unidentified man committed an armed robbery at a church in St. Benedict, Kansas, and fled the scene in an older car bearing a Florida license plate. The suspect was never caught, but Gregory could not overlook how much his composite sketch resembled the Swain's killer and the fact that both crimes took place at a church. However, the lead ultimately went nowhere. The case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries in November of 1988 and generated an interesting call to their tip line. A Camden County woman named Jane Beaver claimed that she believed the composite sketch bore a resemblance to Dennis Perry, the former boyfriend of her daughter, Carol Ann Young. Perry used to live in Camden County, but had moved to the town of Jonesboro to live with his mother 3 months before the murders. Before that, he used to live with his grandparents, whose home was only about a half mile away from where the Swains lived. Around the time they were killed, Perry had apparently phoned his ex-girlfriend to let her know that he had returned to Camden County after hitching a ride on the back of his brother's motorcycle and had broken into his grandparents' home since they weren't there at the time. However, when Perry was investigated by the GBI, he appeared to have a solid alibi, as he worked a construction job at a concrete company in Atlanta. Perry's foreman verified that he was working until around 4:30 to 5 p.m. on March 11th, and a drive from Atlanta to Waverly would take around 4.5 hours at the minimum. When Vanzola Williams was shown a photo lineup with Perry's picture, she failed to pick him out as the shooter, so the GBI cleared him as a suspect. The investigation hit a standstill until 1998, when the Camden County Sheriff's Office used confiscated drug money in order to hire a new full-time investigator named Dale Bundy to work the case, and it wasn't long before he crossed paths with Jane Beaver, who was still convinced that Dennis Perry was the killer. According to Beaver, when the case was shown in reruns on Unsolved Mysteries, she had continuously called their tip line and tried to get in touch with law enforcement, but no one ever got back to her. Bundy agreed to speak with Beaver, and she shared a story about how 3 weeks before the murders, Perry told her that he had visited the home of one of his grandparents' neighbors to borrow money, but this guy ridiculed him for it. Perry reportedly stewed about the incident, and while he never specifically referred to Harold Swain by name, he used racial slurs to describe this neighbor and said he wanted to kill him. This compelled Bundy to reinvestigate Perry as a suspect, and he would show Perry's mugshot, which was taken in 1991 after he was arrested for a DUI, to Vanzola Williams and Cora Fisher, one of the parishioners who saw the killer inside the church. Even though Williams had failed to pick out Perry in a photo lineup years earlier, both she and Fisher now identified Perry as the shooter. On January 13, 2000, Perry was arrested and charged with the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain. While he was interrogated by police, Perry supposedly made an unofficial confession where he acknowledged that he might have been so high on drugs and alcohol at the time of the murders that he may have been at Rising Daughters Baptist Church without even remembering it and shot the Swains by accident. Perry was offered a plea deal in which he could plead guilty to charges of voluntary manslaughter in exchange for 12 years in prison, but he turned it down and elected to go to trial. In February of 2003, after deliberating for only 3 hours, the jury found Perry guilty on 2 counts of felony murder. Perry could have potentially faced the death penalty, but the prosecution told him that if he agreed to waive his right to appeal, he would receive two consecutive life sentences instead and be eligible for parole after serving a minimum of 20 years. Perry agreed to the deal and was sent to Autry State Prison. However, on July 24, 2007, the Denver Post published an article written by Susan Green, which delivered some surprising revelations about the case and addressed some serious problems with Perry's conviction. For starters, Joe Gregory, the now-retired GBI special agent who originally investigated the murders, flat-out stated, quote, "Perry didn't do it, plain and simple, and that's why we cleared him," end quote. As you'll recall, Gregory had looked into Perry's alibi when he originally popped up on the radar as a suspect and verified that he was at work in Atlanta on the day of the murders and would not have had enough time to travel to Waverly and be at the church by 8:50 p.m. that night. In fact, both Gregory and a former co-worker of Perry's named Charlie Williamson testified on his behalf at the trial. Since Perry did not own a car at that time, Williamson drove Perry to and from work every day and verified that he drove Perry home after picking him up sometime between 4:30 and 5 p.m. on March 11th. Williamson even testified that he remembered these details because he and Perry had seen the composite sketch of the shooter in the papers a few days later and joked about how Perry and the killer could have been twin brothers. Even though Perry had supposedly admitted to killing the Swains while he was being interrogated following his arrest, no recording was made of this confession, and the original notes taken by the investigators were destroyed, leaving only a brief summary of Perry's three-hour interrogation. Perry's ex-girlfriend, Carol Ann Young, was called to the stand at trial because, as you'll recall, Perry had allegedly called her to say that he had traveled to Camden County and broke into his grandparents' home. Even though Carol Ann had supposedly told investigators that this call took place on March 10, 1985, the day before the murders, she maintained on the stand that she could not recall the exact date and that investigators had put words into her mouth. She specifically stated that Dale Bundy was, quote-unquote, insinuating I knew more than I did and I didn't know anything. Perry's grandmother would also testify that nobody had broken into her home in March of 1985. There were also major issues with the photo identification of Perry from the two eyewitnesses, Vanzola Williams and Cora Fisher. You see, Jane Beaver had become so invested in solving the case that she took it upon herself to visit Williams and Fisher on her own time and show her Perry's photograph before she contacted the police, which may have influenced their decision when Dale Bundy formally asked them to identify Perry. In both cases, Bundy only showed Perry's mugshot to the witnesses rather than the standard procedure of asking them to pick the suspect out of a photo lineup. If that wasn't enough, when Bundy visited Cora Fisher's home to question her, she had just suffered a bad fall and summoned medical attention. She was literally shown Perry's photo and asked to ID him while on the floor waiting for the ambulance to arrive. But the most problematic aspect of Perry's trial was the lack of physical evidence. Or should I say, the amount of physical evidence which had been lost by the Camden County Sheriff's Office. This included a metal phone box from the church containing fingerprints which may have been left behind by the killer when he cut the phone lines. A Pepsi bottle found at the scene had also been lost, which could have been significant since a man matching the shooter's description had purchased a Pepsi from a nearby store shortly before the murders. And astonishingly, the most crucial piece of evidence from the scene, the killer's makeshift eyeglasses, also vanished without explanation, and the circumstances of how it happened are pretty incredible. As I mentioned in the intro, when the Unsolved Mystery segment was filmed back in 1988, Robert Stack actually held up these glasses and displayed them on camera. Apparently, the producers had contacted the Camden County Sheriff's Office to ask if they could use them for filming, and they complied, which did not please the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, since the sheriff's office did not ask them for permission or establish a proper chain of custody for the evidence. Officially, the last time anyone remembers seeing those glasses is when Robert Stack displayed them on TV. When asked for comment for the Denver Post article, an Unsolved Mysteries producer claimed she didn't know what happened to the glasses and could not even be certain if the ones shown on TV were the real thing or just a prop. Whatever the case, the glasses were not available to be used as evidence at Perry's trial. He was examined by an optometrist, who concluded that Perry had 20/20 vision and would not have needed to wear glasses, especially if they were prescribed for a far-sighted person. However, Jane Beaver testified that she had seen Perry wearing glasses at one point back in 1985, and that he told her he used them for reading. But even though the glasses themselves were missing, one crucial piece of evidence had been preserved: the two Caucasian hairs found in the glasses' hinges. DNA testing was performed, and they excluded Perry as the owner of the hairs, but they were not actually introduced into evidence at trial. The problem is that a big portion of the defense's case would hinge on pointing the finger at an alternate suspect, Donnie Barentine, but the DNA from the hairs did not match him either. Barentine was offered immunity from prosecutors to testify and deny his involvement in the murders, so if the defense wanted to use the DNA evidence, they would have to acknowledge that it excluded Barentine. For this reason, the hairs were not introduced, even though they favored the case for Perry's innocence. Anyway, even though the Denver Post article now casts some serious doubt on Perry's conviction, there really wasn't much he could do about it, since he had waived his right to appeal in order to avoid the death penalty. In spite of this, the Georgia Innocence Project eventually agreed to take his case, and in 2015, they filed a motion for additional DNA testing on some of the remaining evidence from the murder scene, which had not been lost. These included shell casings from the gun, and five buttons found in the vestibule. Since Harold was not missing any buttons from his clothing, these buttons were presumably ripped off the shooter's clothes during the struggle. And even though the church's metal phone box had gone missing, the telephone wires were still in evidence and could potentially have the killer's DNA. It was hoped that these items could be used for contact DNA testing, a process which was not available at the time Perry went on trial. However, I have no idea if this motion has been granted, or if any DNA testing has been done. Dennis Perry continues to serve his two consecutive life sentences, and debate remains whether he really was responsible for the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain, or if someone else has gotten away with it. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Well, this story turned out to be a much bigger rabbit hole than I anticipated, particularly for a case which is officially considered to be solved. There is a surprisingly large amount of material available online if you search hard enough, as an old blog at dennisperry.trial.blogspot.com has the transcripts for Perry's trial posted, and they're quite an interesting read. Now, for years, whenever Unsolved Mysteries ran this segment in syndication, they would cut out an entire section about Donnie Barentine, and once you saw their update about Dennis Perry getting charged with the murders, you never think about the possibility that they might have convicted the wrong man. It wasn't until the segment was uploaded to Amazon Prime last year, when I saw the full unedited version again, which actually devotes a substantial amount of time to the investigation into Barentine. Part of me wonders if the decision to remove the section on Barentine in syndication might have come about after it was revealed that the eyeglasses from the murder scene had gone missing after Robert Stack held them in his hands while filming. Now, I have my doubts that Robert Stack or anyone associated with Unsolved Mysteries personally lost those glasses. It's my guess that the Camden County Sheriff's Office probably lost them at some point after the show gave them back, but I can see Unsolved Mysteries wanting to distance themselves from this, as they don't want to be seen as potentially being responsible for losing evidence which could have exonerated an innocent man. When you couple in the fact that the Camden County Sheriff's Office inexplicably lost so many other key pieces of evidence from the murder scene, I have no reason to believe they didn't lose the glasses as well. It's pretty astonishing that they would just provide such an important piece of evidence to Unsolved Mysteries without consulting with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and establishing a proper chain of custody. One of the representatives should have been on set to take those glasses back from Robert Stack the moment he was done filming and made a record of it. I think you might be able to chalk this up to the Camden County authorities having inexperience at handling a crime of this magnitude. I think it's pretty telling that the more seasoned investigator on the case, GBI Special Agent Joe Gregory, has gone on record to say that they convicted the wrong person and that Dennis Perry is completely innocent. But even if Perry was guilty, there are many troubling things about the case against him, and it's hardly airtight. He supposedly confessed to the crime after he was arrested, even though no recordings or notes about this alleged confession exist. Even though Perry was originally cleared as a suspect by the GBI, the main reason the investigation into him was relaunched was because of the persistence of an amateur sleuth, Jane Beaver, who seemed to have a grudge against him. Beaver made no bones about the fact that she did not like Perry dating her daughter because he was apparently into drugs at that time, but they had broken up before the murders even took place, and for some reason, she seemed bound and determined to prove he was a killer. There was no hard physical evidence to link Perry to the crime, and evidence which could have potentially excluded him was lost. It seems like Perry was largely convicted on the two eyewitnesses who identified him as the shooter, but it's been demonstrated time and time again in criminal cases that eyewitness testimony can be unreliable. It's particularly problematic that Vanzola Williams, the witness who spoke to and came face to face with the killer, did not pick Perry's picture out of the photo lineup the first time she was asked to identify him. This was only a few years after the crime, yet when she's asked to ID Perry again, about a decade later, she now says it's him? I don't see why Williams' memory should be considered more reliable after more time has passed. It's likely that Williams and the second witness, Cora Fisher, were unfairly influenced when they were asked to ID Perry after only being shown a mugshot of him, rather than being asked to pick him out of a photo lineup. In that situation, it's easy to believe, well, the police seem to think he's the guy, so he must be the guy. There's also the fact that Beaver took it upon herself to independently visit Cora Fisher and showed her Perry's photo before she contacted the police. According to Beaver, Fisher became emotional when she saw Perry and instantly became convinced he was the shooter. But you have to remember that Fisher only saw him for a few seconds from a distance and was seeing this photo over a decade after the fact. If you look at the motion filed by the Georgia Innocence Project for additional DNA testing, you'll see a bunch of exhibits they attached, one of which is a chart which lists the eyewitness accounts of each parishioner who was at the church that night. It's pretty amazing to see just how many contradictory details they provided about the shooter, such as his hair color, clothing, and facial hair. This is why it was difficult to put together a composite sketch of him. Most of the photos I've seen of Perry were taken years after the murder, and he doesn't really look that much like the sketch, but no one knows how accurate it really is. You'd think it would be easy to get a consensus on whether or not the killer wore glasses, but the witnesses couldn't even agree on that. Vanzola Williams, who interacted with the guy, never even mentioned anything about glasses until she testified at a pre-trial hearing in 2001. Of course, even if he wasn't wearing them, it's possible that the killer still had glasses in his possession and accidentally dropped them at the scene, but for all we know, those glasses could have been left there by another person at an earlier time and have no connection to the crime. The point is, when multiple eyewitnesses can't even agree on a major detail like whether or not a suspect wore glasses, you can't consider any of their accounts to be 100% reliable. So let's examine Dennis Perry's alibi at the time of the murders. I have to say, when I first heard that Perry was working in Atlanta that day until around 4:30 to 5 p.m., I couldn't believe the jury would disregard that and find him guilty. It seemed very unlikely he could have made it to Waverly in time to commit the murders at 8:50, especially when you factor in other things like rush hour traffic in Atlanta at the time Perry would have left work. However, once I read the trial transcripts, I realized the alibi wasn't as rock solid as I thought. The only evidence the defense presented to support it was the testimony of Perry's former co-worker, Charlie Williamson, who claimed he drove Perry to and from work that day. They did not produce any time cards or work records, which conclusively proved that Perry was in Atlanta on March 11, 1985. Now, there's no reason to believe Williamson would have lied about any of this, but I think the issue might have been that at the time he took the stand, He was a frail 76-year-old man who had already suffered two strokes by that point, and he was remembering a specific day from 18 years earlier. I suppose that if the jury found the prosecution's case to be more convincing, they could have easily assumed that Williamson was mistaken about picking up Perry from work on that particular day. All that being said, when Perry first showed up on the radar as a suspect, Joe Gregory checked into his alibi and got a confirmation from Perry's foreman that he was working on March 11th, and this was only a few years after the murders, when memories would have been fresher. I don't know if Gregory found more hard evidence like time cards to confirm that Perry was at work, but he became satisfied that Perry's alibi checked out and that he did not commit the crime. But even if Perry's alibi didn't hold up, there's still the matter of how he would have made the trip from Atlanta to Waverly to begin with, since he did not own a car. Now, Perry's ex-girlfriend shared a story about him making a trip to Camden County on the back of his brother's motorcycle, but it's up for dispute whether this trip took place around the time of the murders. Even so, if Perry's brother gave him a motorcycle ride to Camden County on March 10th or 11th, this should have been easy to verify, but it doesn't sound like this was the case. And there's also a question of motive. Perry claimed he did know who Harold Swain was, but never actually met him. The official version of events, originally pushed forward by Jane Beaver, is that Perry tried to borrow money from Harold, but got enraged when Harold ridiculed him for it. And according to Beaver, Perry said he always wanted to kill a black person and used a racial slur to describe Harold. Well, I've got issues with this story, as Harold was known as a kind, generous man who gave handouts to transients who frequented his church. Even if he did turn down Perry's request to lend him money, Harold doesn't sound like the type of person who would ridicule someone for asking for help. And besides, if Perry's motive for this crime was driven by Harold's refusal to give him money, why would he leave $300 behind in Harold's pocket? But even if Beaver's story is true, she claimed Perry never actually referred to Harold by name, so perhaps he had attempted to borrow money from some other black man and was just venting and making empty threats. There's also the matter of the missing eyeglasses, as Perry had 20/20 vision and had no need to even own a pair of glasses, let alone wear them when committing a murder. Yes, Jane Beaver claimed that Perry used glasses for reading, but she's not exactly the most objective witness. I have to say that I'm not sure Perry received adequate legal counsel for this trial, as his defense attorney made some crucial mistakes. The biggest one was the decision to not admit the results of the DNA testing on the hairs from the eyeglasses into evidence. Even though they excluded Perry, they also excluded Donnie Barentine, and the defense felt it would be more important to their case if they diverted suspicion towards Barentine as the real killer. Well, I wouldn't agree with that strategy, because the defense's job is to generate reasonable doubt for their client, not to try and prove who actually committed the crime. The case against Barentine was not exactly rock solid, so if the defense told the jury that the one piece of remaining physical evidence from the scene seemed to exclude Perry as the perpetrator, they might have had a better chance of securing an acquittal. It was also a big mistake for Perry's attorney to advise him to agree to waive his right to appeal in order to avoid the death penalty. I understand that Perry must have been terrified by the idea of being executed and was essentially told, "Take this deal or you're going to fry." But he should have been made aware of the fact that he had the right to go through numerous appeals on death row before the execution ever went through. I'm guessing Perry didn't want to take that risk, but without having the right to appeal, he's got a major uphill battle if he ever wants to get his conviction overturned. Since Perry was agreeing to accept two life sentences, part of me wondered if perhaps this was an admission of guilt, but let's not forget that he was originally offered a plea deal in which he'd only have to serve 12 years for voluntary manslaughter, and he turned it down. I doubt Perry would have even been offered a deal like that to begin with if the prosecution didn't have such a weak case. After going over the entire trial transcript, I definitely believe the evidence against Perry just wasn't that strong, and that he probably should have taken his chances appealing the conviction. While I can't say with absolute 100% certainty that Perry is innocent, I really don't think his guilt was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So let's now look at the prime alternate suspect. There's a lot to suggest this crime was premeditated, and that the killer specifically targeted Harold. He went to the trouble of cutting the church's phone lines. He specifically asked to speak to Harold when he went inside, and he also let Vanzola Williams walk out the front door and didn't seem too concerned about the fact that she'd seen his face. During the Unsolved Mysteries segment, Joe Gregory talked about how the composite sketch of the shooter was remarkably similar to the sketch of another unidentified suspect who robbed a church in Kansas, but I'm inclined to think that's just a coincidence and nothing more than a red herring. As has been mentioned before, $300 was left behind in Harold's pocket, so robbery was not the motive in this particular case. Due to the conflicting eyewitness accounts, no one can be certain just how accurate the composite sketch of the killer is, so the fact that it resembles the sketch for a suspect in another crime really doesn't mean that much. It is interesting how the guy who robbed the church in Kansas drove a car with a Florida license plate, and some people believe the Swain's killer was from Florida, but it sounds like this lead never went anywhere. So now we have to look at Donnie Barentine as a suspect. I can see the resemblance between Barentine and the composite sketch, though the key difference is that Barentine had long dark hair at that time, and the suspect was described as having light colored shoulder length hair. Vanzola Williams thought Barentine looked like the shooter, but couldn't positively ID him. And of course, three witnesses claimed that Barentine bragged about being involved in the murders at a party, though it seems like there was a substantial amount of drugs and alcohol at that party. Other than that, there really isn't much evidence against Barentine, and most importantly, DNA testing on the hairs from the eyeglasses excluded him. And I've also seen no indication that Barentine ever wore glasses. But there are two other possibilities here. Number one, the glasses were actually dropped there earlier that night by someone who had no connection to the crime. Or number two, Barentine traveled to Waverly with an accomplice, and this man actually did the shootings. Remember, Barentine had an unidentified blonde man with him when he attended the party, and while the stories from the witnesses were inconsistent, one version involved Barentine saying that he waited outside the church while his companion went inside to commit the murders. Now, it goes without saying that since these witnesses were involved in drugs, alcohol, and criminal activity, you have to take their stories with a grain of salt, and I certainly wouldn't have pursued murder charges against Barentine if their testimony was the primary evidence. And of course, Barentine also could have just read about the murders in the newspaper and bragged about them, even though he had nothing to do with it. It's also worth mentioning that Jeff Cottrell was shown the composite sketch of the killer at Perry's trial and said he did not think it was the blonde man he saw with Barentine at the party, but again, the sketch might not be 100% accurate. However, if Barentine was telling the truth, and he merely waited outside the church while his blonde companion murdered the Swains, and happened to leave behind a pair of eyeglasses in the process, then this would explain why the DNA on the hairs has never been matched to anyone. I don't believe Vanzola Williams ever reported seeing anyone else standing outside the church, but she immediately took off running to the back door when she heard the gunshots, so she never saw the killer leave, and could have easily missed any accomplices he might have had. But let's examine Barentine's alibi. Unlike with Dennis Perry, there was actually a time card from Barentine's workplace in Marianna, Florida, which was entered into evidence at the trial. It showed that Barentine was working from 7 a.m. until 3:29 p.m. on the day of the crime. He was actually still living in Marianna at the time he was called to testify at Perry's trial, and when the prosecution asked how long it took him to travel there, Barentine replied, about 6 hours. I think this was done to plant the seed in the jury's minds that Barentine would not have had enough time to leave work in Marianna and drive to Waverly to murder the Swains. But a search of Google Maps shows that the trip from Marianna to Waverly actually takes just over 4 hours. Of course, Marianna is in the central time zone and 1 hour behind Waverly, so the timeline would be a bit tight. But if Barentine drove there immediately after he left work, he theoretically could have made it by 8:50 p.m. Joe Gregory even testified that he performed the drive at the time he was investigating Barentine and made it to the church with about 30 to 45 minutes to spare. So now we have to look at motive, because you'd assume Barentine would need a pretty strong reason to make a 4-hour drive to kill someone. Well, the only motive which has ever been offered was provided by Jeff Cottrell, who claimed this was an attempt to draw Harold Swain's son-in-law out of hiding because he owed a drug debt to Barentine's cousin. but I've never heard anything to substantiate this claim, and know nothing about Harold's son-in-law, or if he might have been involved in drugs, so again, take this claim with a grain of salt. I know Cottrell also mentioned that before they were pulled over by police, Barentine's cousin had sent them to Macon to perform a hit on a drug dealer in a fashion that was very similar to how Harold was murdered, as it involved cutting phone lines. But I have to assume this blonde man who supposedly accompanied Barentine to the party was not his cousin, because otherwise, Cottrell would have identified him. It drives me nuts that we have this mysterious blonde guy associated with Barentine who could potentially be the Swains' killer, but no one actually knows who he is. There's also the eyewitness sighting from the store clerk, who claimed that a man matching the killer's description purchased a Pepsi from her about a half hour before the murders took place. I actually put some stock into this sighting, because a Pepsi bottle was found at the murder scene, but of course, those geniuses at the Camden County Sheriff's Office wound up losing it. Due to the makeshift nature of his eyeglasses, it was always believed that the killer did not have the money to afford a decent pair, and that would certainly fit the profile of someone who had trouble scrounging up enough money to purchase a 55-cent Pepsi. Then again, it's strange that someone so poor would not steal the $300 from Harold's pocket, but this is another sign that Harold's death was not a botched attempted robbery, and he was specifically targeted. It's also interesting how the guy at the store went back to his car in order to get the remaining 5 cents to pay for the Pepsi. It's possible he was just scrounging for change, but if another person, such as Donnie Barentine, was waiting inside the car, maybe they gave him the rest of the money. It would be interesting to know if Barentine, or anyone associated with him, owned an orange Plymouth-type vehicle like the one the clerk described. So there's an interesting case to be made that Barentine had something to do with this crime, but there's no strong motive, no hard evidence placing him at the scene, a piece of DNA evidence which does not match him, and the primary theory involves an unidentified blonde accomplice who may or may not even exist. But I'd also say that the case against Dennis Perry being the killer really isn't that much stronger than the case against Barentine, yet he is serving time in prison. Perry is not a squeaky clean individual, as by his own admission, he had issues with drugs and alcohol at that time, and has at least one DUI on his record. But as far as I can tell, he doesn't have any known history of violence, and there's no evidence he ever owned a gun. Whereas Barentine was arrested after unregistered automatic weapons were found inside his trunk, and he wound up serving 5 years in prison for that. Honestly, it would not surprise me if the perpetrator was an unknown person who's never even popped up on the radar, and the initial theory about a transient being responsible might be the correct one. In fact, it would not surprise me at all if the crime was race-related. Waverly was a predominantly African-American town in the South, and Harold Swain was one of their community leaders, so the killer may have simply wanted to commit a hate crime. When racism is involved, you really don't need a complicated motive, as this person may not have even known Harold Swain personally, but targeted him because of the color of his skin. If this crime was some random, racially motivated murder committed by someone who didn't live in the area, then it would be harder to track him down. Of course, if you believe Jane Beaver's story about Dennis Perry using racial slurs when talking about wanting to kill Harold, then perhaps the crime really was driven by racism, and the right man is in prison for this crime. But I have my doubts about that. You see, the main thing which makes me believe that something really shady is going on with this case is not just that so much evidence was lost by the Camden County Sheriff's Office, but that most of it was physical evidence, which could have potentially exonerated Perry and proven he wasn't the killer. How is it that all the evidence containing fingerprints just happened to go missing? And most of the evidence they didn't lose, such as the shell casings from the gun and the shirt buttons, did not help Perry's case, because contact DNA testing did not exist at that time, so none of this could prove he did not commit the crime. Doesn't that strike anyone as a convenient coincidence? Without all this hard physical evidence, all they really had was shaky eyewitness testimony, an alleged confession which was never actually recorded, and an amateur sleuth who seemed to have a personal vendetta against the defendant. Considering that the sheriff's office spent all this money hiring Dale Bundy to investigate the case full-time, it sounds like they had the mindset that it must be closed no matter what, but if they find a good suspect and the evidence happens to lean away from them, well, they can just make it disappear. Overall, I'm inclined to think that Perry was not guilty of this crime, but if he was, the prosecution really didn't prove their case, and the trial might have turned out differently if all that crucial evidence hadn't been lost, and the defense had admitted the one piece of DNA evidence which seemed to exclude Perry as the perpetrator. I know it's been 3 years since the Georgia Innocence Project filed their motion for contact DNA testing on the remaining evidence, and I'm not sure if it ever went anywhere. Since Perry waived his right to appeal, I'm afraid they'll have to turn up some really strong, conclusive, exculpatory evidence if he has any chance at getting his conviction overturned. Otherwise, the only shot he has of getting out of prison is hoping that he can attain parole after serving 20 years. The whole situation sounds like a terrible injustice, not just for Dennis Perry, but for Harold and Thelma Swain, who sounded like genuinely good people who were senselessly murdered, and I have a feeling that the real perpetrator was not punished for this crime. So while I would like to call this one of Unsolved Mysteries' success stories, my gut tells me that this is not actually a solved case, and that real closure has yet to be attained. If the right person was convicted of this crime, then that's great, but should you happen to have any information which suggests that someone else besides Dennis Perry was responsible for the murders of the Swains, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've released some neat bonus episodes for our donors in tiers 2 and 3, and we'll be releasing another one this month, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who is responsible for our eerie music score. And of course, I'll also be appearing at the Canadian Crime Podcast event, a live show being held at the Hideout Bar in Toronto in just under 3 weeks on July 22nd. It will include myself and a number of other Canadian True Crime podcasters, including Christy from Canadian True Crime, Jordan from the Nighttime Podcast, and Jack from Dark Topic. And a couple of our American true crime podcasting friends are also going to be making the trip and will be in attendance, including Nina Instead from Already Gone and Charlie from Insight. Tickets are only $10, and you can find a link to our Eventbrite page to purchase them in our episode description. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Hey.